From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. There's an expression which goes, you can look but not see. In his latest book, Everyday Wonders, Barry Evans shows us that there is much to see in the universe of our everyday lives. I'll speak with Barry about how learning to wonder about the phenomena around us can teach both science and philosophy. Later, I'll talk with Brad Chase. Brad is in charge of arguably the most frequently used software program today, Microsoft's DOS, the operating system you find on most personal computers. We'll find out how many people it takes to support this product, and we'll look at the latest features which have been introduced into this constantly evolving software program. Barry Evans' new book, Everyday Wonders, encourages us to look more closely at the world around us and to ponder. I wondered, what does the exercise or the habit of wondering bring to our lives?
Oh, I think it's something that was innate in all of us when we were kids. You know, when we were like 3-4 years old, we were little mobile questioning machines, and we were always asking why the sky is blue, why trees grow upwards, all those questions that we ask as kids. And I think it's an expression of our natural innate wonder and curiosity. I think what happens is that we go to school, and I quote, there's a sad quote by philosopher writer Neil Postman, who says, children go into school as question marks and come out as periods. And in my case, that was somewhat true, that certainly the answer through school became more important than the question. So by the end of school, I think to some extent, I'd lost, and I think a lot of us in this society, have lost that natural wondering sense that we have when we're kids. And I think the greatest artists and scientists and the people, the most creative people, have still got very much alive that sense of wondering that we started off with. And they haven't lost it. And they've, you know, I talk about scientists as being little girls and little boys who never grew up from that point of view. They never lost that innate sense of wonder and curiosity.
Well, Everyday Wonders is an interesting combination of facts and stories and puzzles and interviews and quotations. In your interview with Linus Pauling, he says he's constantly looking for a phenomenon he doesn't understand, and he's thinking about it. It's as if he has this habit of wondering.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, here he is. He's, what, 91 years old now. I interviewed him a year ago. Double Nobel Prize winner. I mean, this is no mean scientist. And I think he's exemplifying exactly what it is that makes good scientists, is that they see something they don't understand and immediately start wondering about it. I think this is such a delightful exercise to do for us all, whether we're scientists or not, because there's something very present about wondering. You can't wonder about the future. You know, you wonder, you stop and you look around and there's something. You know, why are traffic lights, why is go green and red stop? Why not the other way around or something? This just sort of, it's a very momentarily in the present thing. In that sense, I think it's a wonderful exercise to bring us into the moment, which is where our lives are anyway.
Independent of incorporating our life experience and what we do every day, we all have a tendency to examine the world around us in terms of our life experience. And yet you succinctly caution the reader to remember, that was then, and this is now.
Sure. I mean, now is the present. Now is the only moment. All the past is just present memories of the past, and the future is extrapolated, you know, memories from the past.
So we have to keep looking at things, even though we think we've assimilated it.
Well, we don't have to, but it adds such a wonderful dimension to our lives. You know, the idea of being 4 and 5 again is very appealing anyway, but with the adult knowledge that we've already got. And so if we can incorporate the two, which again I think is what good artists, good scientists do, the best ones, if you and I can do it in our lives and maintain that curiosity and wonder and yet have some of the maturity that we know we can find out how to answer the questions that we automatically ask, it gives this added dimension of wonder and fun to our lives.
In that same interview with Linus Pauling, he talked about letting his unconscious work on a problem. Describe that process.
Well, I'm not sure. He's talking about it, and I'm quoting him. His idea is that he'll come up with a problem which he just can't solve, and he'll work at it in the conscious level for, say, a week. And then what he says is that he tucks it away into his unconscious or his subconscious, whatever model you use, and leaves it there. And he has this one. He has several examples, but his best example was he did this with one example for 35 years. He had this problem stuck away in his brain for 35 years. He says he hardly thought about it at all, and then he was reading 35 years later a paper which was very peripherally related to the original problem, and it was like, oh yeah, that's the answer to my problem. And he just got it in that moment. And clearly his unconscious, or in his opinion anyway, the unconscious had been doing something. It's sifting through and playing with this idea so that all he needed was one more piece of the puzzle, and was like, click, and he got it.
The reason I asked you about it is when I was in graduate school, of course, every day I was constantly trying to solve new problems, all programming and getting engineering systems together. And what I found was effective is before I went to bed, I would formulate which problem I wanted to solve next. And 9 times out of 10, I'd wake up in the morning and I knew the answer. And I never even thought about that process until I read the Linus Pauling interview. I said, yes, that's interesting. One of the things he said in the interview, he was talking about someone else who did the same thing.
Avicenna, I think.
That's right. And it worked for him, Dr. Pauling said, because he very carefully formulated the problem or the question.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this wasn't, it wasn't like any, he didn't want any vague answer. He got it very, very clear. And I think what's important with both your example of yourself and with Linus Pauling is the intention. You know, we give our brains, the black box, whatever it is, the intention that we want to know the answer. And somehow it understands intention at some level, I think.
You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans in Technology. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Barry Evans. He writes the syndicated column Star Watch, which appears throughout the United States. Everyday Wonders, we were saying, was a combination of facts and stories and interviews and puzzles. How did you come upon this format? How did you decide?
Well, I've got a very short attention span. I'm a recovering civil engineer, and that goes with the territory, I think. And, you know, one of the original titles for the book was The Bathroom Reader. In other words, you know, something that you could pick up for 5 minutes, and then when you were done, you put down again, right?
They didn't
and
tell so, me that, Barry.
Yeah. So my own style of reading, I love dipping into. I love Stephen Jay Gould's essays. I love essays from people where I can just read them and be done with them without having to carry on through. Jim Treffel, the physicist writer, wonderful example of this. He'll write about something and you can get it in 10 minutes and then put it down. I mean, that's why magazines are so popular, of course, because you don't have to plow through hours of reading and keep the continuity going. So what I try to do is to entertain myself as the writer in the way that I hope the reader will be entertained, that they can go in and they can dip and choose. And if someone's real anal retentive, they can start on page one and go through to the end and stop. But
nothing to prevent
for
you.
For most of us. I don't think there's any check in there. No.
Well, I find that fairly interesting for a science book because generally it's like at least you have to commit to a chapter.
Well, I've got a point of view that most popular science books aren't that popular. In other words, they're popular among people who are already in the fold. They're popular among people who read Scientific American and Discover and whatever other magazines are out there. But what I'm trying to do is to appeal to a larger audience. I want to be, if you like, I want to appeal to, in this book, to people who hated science or didn't do well at science at school. Because I'm trying to say, look, this is science light. You don't have to understand science. You don't even have to like it. But let me just show you a few things of how you can look around and notice everyday stuff like air and water and gravity and mirrors and circles. And with just a little bit of knowledge, which I give them in the book, you can appreciate it at a much higher level and enjoy it at a much higher level than you might otherwise do.
One of the concepts which you talk about in the book is the artificial constructs we place on time, the 7-day week which we know versus the 4-day week in rural Africa today versus the 10-day week of revolutionary France. And of course, today they take the whole month of August out, so I don't know what their calendars look like.
By the way, there is no natural 7-day period.
Well, that's just it. I mean, what are we doing to ourselves with a 7-day week?
Well, it has its origins. We know where it came from, about 3,000 years ago, probably in Mesopotamia. And it was picked up by the Hebrews. And of course, you know, God created the world in 6 days and rested on the seventh. And there's our 7-day week. So it was pretty well brought in from the outside into Western culture. But it's a totally artificial construct, as is the hour, as is the minute. I mean, there are only really three natural time periods that we use. The year, time now, planet goes around the sun, the lunar month, the time from new moon to new moon, and the day, the time it takes for the sun to be overhead from one day to the next. All other units of time are artificial.
And that is interesting. The science fact has to do with like a day, the one full revolution of the Earth, but how many days make a quantum in the terms of a week is simply
sure.
not relevant.
Sure, as you mentioned, as because other cultures have got totally different lengths of time. The Baha'i faith has a 19-day week.
That's a long day to rest.
I know. I don't know how long they have the weekend.
Really?
I like the idea of these 4-day weeks. That makes sense. Yeah.
You interviewed Joseph Schwartz, the physics professor who wrote Einstein for Beginners and later The Creative Moment, How Science Made Itself Alien to Modern Culture. And about popular science writing, he says, I think one of the very worst things we can do is exciting readers and students with awe and wonder. And here you are trying to get everybody wondering.
Well, he's a funny guy, by the way. I was in London last year and I interviewed him. He lives in London now. And I'm a great admirer of his. And here's how much I'm an admirer. My wife, who is not a science file by any means, she accepts science, but she doesn't get excited by it. We were reading his book in bed to each other. That's how. So he's a fascinating writer, and he moves. He breaks many boundaries. His point of view is that there's a gee whiz factor about science. You see it every time there's a space shuttle launch or we go past planets, in which the scientists often feel that they have to inject this gee whiz factor, and this is so great, this is so wonderful, and it's done in such a way that when all the shouting is over, it's like, well, what are we left with? And his point of view is if we're doing that, we're shooting ourselves in the foot. We've got to tell people just this is the way it is and allow them to see the wonder for themselves rather than tell them how wonderful it is.
This is the soft sell versus the hard sell. Yeah,
exactly. Exactly. And which lasts longer?
Yeah. I don't know, but the scientists are all out there shaking their heads.
Yeah. With reason.
With good reason. I was fascinated by your photographs of that left-right symmetry. You use one portrait of a woman and then the same example of a man, who looks strikingly familiar to me now. And then you flip the photo and splice it. So on the left, you see a person's regular face. And then you see basically two right sides put together into
mirrored,
a face.
Yes.
Mirrored, and then two left sides. And I kept searching those faces. I was fascinated. You know, I searched the faces again and again. How different you look.
It's astonishing. We tend to think of ourselves as bilaterally symmetrical, right? You know, that we're supposed to look about the same in our right and left sides. But I urge anyone to do this, to go take some photographs of a face and, you know, keep it fairly upright so and the light is about the same, and then have the photo processor print it the other way around. So
or just reverse it, which happens sometimes. You get them back.
Exactly,
saying,
exactly.
I have the pin on the other
back
side.
Back to front, right.
Yeah.
And then just cut them down the middle and splice two lefts and two rights together. And that's the best way of seeing how different we are on our left and right. And the idea is, I'm not sure, I didn't really prove this in the book, but I throw this up for for discussion anyway. Yeah, anyone who wants to grab it, is that our left side, our sinister, you know, Latin, sinister side, right, is the more sinister, is the more, is the deeper, is the more mysterious, the badder side, you know, and that our right side is the more open, friendly side. And, you know, there's the notion that when we look at ourselves in the mirror, we're seeing ourselves how other people see us. They don't. They see us, or we see ourselves in the mirror, mirror reversed. In other words, when I'm looking at you now across the table, I'm seeing you the opposite way that you see yourself in the mirror in the morning. Mm. And there's a way of handling, if you really want to see yourself as other people see you, you get two mirrors, you hold them at right angles in front of you, and you have a double reflection there, and then you'll end up seeing yourself as other people see you.
While we're on the topic of symmetry, is it really true, and I hope I can say this on public radio, is it really true, you say this in your book, that a man's left testicle hangs lower than his right?
That's what they tell me, yeah. Mine does. I checked.
I had nothing to check.
But I haven't checked with anyone else. So.
Well, you can imagine my reticence to this is truly an everyday wonder.
Yeah, you should probably check with someone who does vasectomies as a rule. Like that. But I think, yeah, I've read that in more than one occasion, so I think it's beyond folklore.
So we're really not symmetrical.
Yeah, check with Ed back there.
We'll ask our engineer later. He's under the control console now. My guest today is Barry Evans. He's the author of a number of books, including The Wrong Way Comet and Other Mysteries of Our Solar System. I'm Moira Gunn, and you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. There were a lot of puzzles in your book, and being a former math major myself, I love it when I see puzzles. I just go in there and I thought, I can figure this out. Well, they weren't all that easy.
Oh, good. I think there is some of the trickier puzzles haven't had a lot of training in math or in puzzle solving. The more innocent ones tend to get some of those sooner because there's a certain naivety associated with solving them. You need to be innocent to solve some of those. But, you know, with puzzles, some people hate puzzles. You know, they did badly at school or whatever, and they hated puzzles, and they hate puzzles. And I recognize this, but I think puzzles have got a really useful place in education and in people who read my book, for instance, because it's like yoga for the mind. Puzzles, I talk about this, puzzles kind of keep our brains limber, I think. So what I've done to try to encourage puzzle phobes to take a look at puzzles is I've given graduated hints in the puzzle. So if they really can't get it, they can peek at hint one without looking at the next two hints because the hints get more and more obvious.
That was good. I like that part. Uh-huh. And I was, you know, hold up, you know, with my hands over the hints.
Yeah, right. That's
and
good.
Then you actually go from one puzzle to the next puzzle giving hints for the form of puzzle.
Mm-hmm.
You really had me there.
You've got to be sneaky with this. So.
Yeah, I finally would give up and look at the answer and say, darn, I should have known that. But it exercised many different parts of my brain. I think we're used to puzzles. We get used to what's expected from the puzzles we do.
Yeah.
And these were very much different ways of thinking and looking. And when I turned around and say, and wondering, there are many different ways of wondering.
I think that's true, yeah. I'm on my way after this interview to listen to Edward de Bono, who wrote the books on lateral thinking, and he had some wonderful puzzles in his books where his point is that most of our thinking is very lateral, is very B follows A, C follows B, and so on, but there's another way of thinking, and the most creative people, scientists, artists, what have you, tend to get outside of that lateral pattern and tend to go outside of it and look back at the bigger picture. That's what wondering is, I think, is looking at the bigger picture.
You are writing about wonder and science, and yet you enthusiastically quote philosopher after philosopher. The ability to wonder is certainly a job requirement for a philosopher. Science majors don't usually take philosophy.
Oh, I think there's a lot in common between philosophy, religion, and science. which is we're all looking at the mysterious. We're all trying to understand the mysterious. Totally different formats, and some people would argue that there isn't much common content. But I think underneath it, there is a sense that there is the mystery out there. And scientists are going to understand it, and philosophers are going to figure it out in a different sort of way, in an epistemological sort of way. You know, so we've all got our different approaches to it, but it's all about the mystery, I think. I quote Lewis Thomas, my hero Lewis Thomas, who's written so many wonderful books and essays on just being alive. And the quote is something like, if we had any sense of the improbability, the statistical improbability of any of us being here, we'd all be dancing around in the dazzlement of surprise, I think is the quote. And yeah, I mean, it's really weird that we are here. From a zillion different ways, I talk about the fact that 65 million years ago, it's pretty well accepted now that a Manhattan Island-sized asteroid hit the Earth, a huge quantity of dust in the atmosphere, photosynthesis stopped, herbivores died, carnivores died, everything on land over 50 pounds died, including all the dinosaurs. Dinosaurs had been around for the previous 160-odd million years. Mammals had been around almost as long, but mammals had stayed small, out of their way. Dinosaurs were the lords of the Earth. There's no reason to suppose that if that asteroid had missed, which could it easily have done, crashed into the sun and instead, that today mammals would still be small, furry, hoping to get through another day without getting eaten, and dinosaurs would still be lords of the Earth. For instance,
you cite a number of things that happen in a second. Talk about that.
Well, first let me back off a little bit and say I started off talking about time from the oft-quoted statement that the universe is about 15 billion years old. Big Bang about 15 billion years ago, give or take 5 billion years. And I go to wondering, well, how long is 15 billion years? I've no idea. It's a long time, but it's an awful long time, a heck of a long time. But I still didn't have any visceral feeling for such a vast sense of time. So I came up with this exercise. Basically, there are about as many 12-second periods in a human lifetime as there are human lifetimes in the age of the universe. The ratio is about the same. So I do this exercise in the book. I get people to imagine that instead of a 72, say, to make the arithmetic fit, year life, they would have a 12-second life. And to imagine, you know, just the first second of this 12-second life would be equivalent to their first 6 years. Second would be equivalent to their second 6 years of life, and so on. And I get people to visualize this and end up just imagining what it might be like to live a 12-second life. And then I say, okay, compare that with what your reasonable expectation of life is. And that's the same ratio as what your lifespan is compared with the age of the universe. Just a hint, just a visceral feeling hint of what it means for the universe to be 15 billion years old.
You know, there are a lot of handles like that in this book. Uh-huh. I was hit when you said that it took a light to reach the moon back to Earth.
It took 2.5 seconds.
And it's like, I could understand that.
But you know, there's something so funny that goes on with historical movies of our time, and one of the ones which is always quoted is Apollo 11 landing on the moon in 1969. And the way that I've seen it on TV documentaries is that Buzz will say, gee, it's a beautiful day up here, how are you doing, Houston? And Houston will say, we're right here, Buzz, we're fascinated by it, and there's no pause. But of course, when it was happening at the time, there was a 2.5 second pause, the time it takes for the radio wave to get from Earth to the moon and back again. The pause is the history. That's the magic, and that's what they've taken out in the interest of keeping this thing nice and short. And I'm not saying KQED or any public radio stations are guilty of this, but I've heard this, and it's so sad that the pause is the history. That's the exciting thing, that there is this 2.5 second pause, because that's how long it took to to get from here to the moon and back again.
That's true. I hadn't thought of it. Let's talk about some of the basic science you talk about in Everyday Wonders.
What I try to do is to start off with something that I imagine a 3 or 4 year old might ask and go on from there. When I was a kid in England, I believe I said, what happens if you drill a hole straight down through the earth? And I was told, will you come out in China? I came to North America a few years ago and I happened to ask a few kids, what happens? Oh, you come out in China. Now, both of us can't be right. In fact, both of us are wrong. If you drill down from North America, you come out in the middle of the Indian Ocean. You end up very wet, except there are two spots near Denver, Colorado. You have to drill exactly the right spot, and you'll come out on these two tiny islands, French islands, in the middle of the Indian Ocean. That's the only exception for the contiguous 48 states. So I start off with this idea, the kid's natural sense, what happens if you drill straight down? And then I go into, well, suppose you could drill a hole right through the, you know, there are some fairly tough problems involved. It's pretty hot and it's pretty dense as you go down through the earth. But suppose you could. Could you then, if you've got a tunnel and you fall halfway and then you decelerate out to the surface, is this a way, is this some futuristic way of getting from point A to point B? In other words, instead of, say, flying from San Francisco to London and going over the earth, you go straight through the earth in a dead straight line, and presumably you wouldn't be using any energy. If this was a vacuum tube, you'd accelerate halfway and then you'd decelerate the rest of the way. Well, there's a problem with that. First, it's interesting that if you make some fairly basic assumptions, it turns out that no matter where you're going, from here to the Indian Ocean or from here to New York or from here to Chicago, it takes about 40 minutes. Because because you go slower, the less distance you go. So it always takes about 40 minutes in theory. There's a problem. The Earth spins, and so instead of just going a nice straight line, you'd be thrown against the side of the tube all the time, so friction would take its toll. Except, there's one place where you could start off from and end up in another place, and you wouldn't be subject to this problem of the Earth spinning, and that's going from the North Pole to the South Pole. So you could drill a hole from the North Pole to the South Pole, have a tube there, jump in, and about 42 minutes later, come out at the other end. And people would say, well, what's the use of that? Well, this is a book. I've got to keep this thing entertaining. I've got to come up with a reason to drill a tube from the North Pole to the South Pole. Well, polar researchers, they spend 6 months at the North Pole, the sun shining. They do their research as they watch the sun finally dipping after 6 months below the horizon. They jump in the hole. 42 minutes later, they come out at the South Pole. They've got another 6 months research ahead of them in daylight again.
So they can take their luggage with them, I suppose.
Exactly. They just jump in, although they do need a free hand to hang on to the edge of the tube where it comes
when
out.
When it comes out.
You can go on with this. An Earth satellite, curious enough, because the math works out that way, takes just the same time. If as you were jumping in the hole at the North Pole, a low-orbit Earth satellite was going overhead, when you came out at the South Pole, that Earth orbit satellite would be coming out. It would be coming around just at the same time.
Because, that's curious.
Well, it isn't, because the numbers
just
fall out.
They're not a true
you
relation.
Can sort of intuit. Yes, it is. It's and you can sort of intuit it in a way. It's like you go from a straight line to a parabola to a circle. You kind of get a feel for this.
For many years now, you've written the column Star Watch. What do you do with Star Watch? What are you trying to accomplish there?
Star Watch is a monthly astronomy column, mainly for non-astronomers and for lay people. And I tell people about what's coming up in the sky the next month, and I give them a little star chart to encourage them to go out and see, oh, there's Mars. Now I know where Mars is. And then I do a commentary, and I do a commentary in the same style, basically, as I've written Everyday Wonders, which is to try and inveigle people in with a little anecdote or story, and then I slip in a little bit of science at the end so they've learned something and hopefully they've been entertained at the same time.
Your earlier book, The Wrong Way Comet and Other Mysteries of Our Solar System, what was The Wrong Way Comet?
Wrong Way Comet is Halley's Comet. There are a few objects, not a lot, a few objects which go the wrong way around the Sun. In other words, the Earth and all the other planets go counterclockwise around the Sun if you start off from north of here. Halley's Comet goes the wrong way. It goes clockwise around the Sun. So it's going the wrong way. And in the book, I explored the possibility in one of the 100-and-something essays that maybe what's going on here is that the comet was actually captured, that it wasn't in an original solar orbit. Since I've written the book, that idea has pretty well been scotched, but it's a good title of the book. So we aren't going to change the title of the book just because.
Yeah, the next book is called Nevermind.
Yeah. But it's still going the wrong way around the Sun, if for perfectly prosaic reasons, in fact.
Barry, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Maria.
My guest today has been Barry Evans. He is the author of Everyday Wonders, Encounters with the Astonishing World Around Us, published by Contemporary Books. You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Computer requires a software program called an operating system. Brad Chase is general manager of Microsoft's DOS, the industry standard for operating systems on PCs. I asked him how many copies of DOS are out there today and on what computers.
Well, in actuality, we don't even know. We estimate that there's over 100 million MS-DOS users worldwide, probably closer to 120 million worldwide now, and they run on almost any basic personal computer you know about, except for, of course, the Macintosh.
We got to ask this question. Why does a computer need a DOS?
That's a good question. The operating system is the software that helps the physical computer work with your applications, like your word processor that you write memos with. It's sort of the intermediary that controls the system. So you need it in order to provide the basic instructions for your applications and, of course, to store your files and be able to manipulate them. In a way, it's sort of like the hub of your office, like a file cabinet or a desk.
Microsoft is now just releasing version 6.2 of DOS. Is this something we should get excited about?
Well, yes, actually it is, because it does many things to help solve some of today's most common computer problems for both MS-DOS and Windows users, such as full hard disks and memory management. And 6.2 specifically adds additional data protection, sort of what I like to call the passenger-size airbag to provide even additional safety for customers.
Now tell us what that means.
What that means is that computers, it's an appliance, it's an electronic device. Things can go wrong sometimes. And like the auto industry, using the analogy further, we're constantly looking for ways to make things safer and easier for customers. So with 6.2, we've added this data protection technology that you can use to diagnose problems on your computer and fix them in most cases.
Okay, now give me a specific example here. I've got a file.
Yeah, okay. For example, you have a hard disk on your computer that all your information is stored on, and your hard disk can go bad. Things can go wrong with it, and often with software, we can fix those problems. So one of the things that the new scan disk tool does in MS-DOS 6.2 is it will scan your hard disk, do what is called a surface scan, look for problems, and if it finds them and can fix them, it will do so for you.
Okay, so it's looking at the data on a hard disk, and it says if everything is right hardware-wise with this hard disk, then all the data ought to look real good.
That's correct.
All right, what's it looking at?
What it's looking at is a bunch of zeros and ones, a bunch of bits and bytes, what we call them. But to you as a user, when you write a document, let's say a memo or a letter or a spreadsheet that has analysis on it, it's stored on the hard disk in information in a way that the computer can understand. So the scan disk is actually looking at the actual hard disk and how the data is encoded on that hard disk to make sure that it's stored properly.
Now, if I go back, and it's been a while since I looked at what's on a hard disk, it seems to me the front end of a hard disk has got something called a VTOC, or a volume table of contents. Probably don't call it that anymore. But it's basically a directory to what's on the hard disk. And I know one thing we used to look at, and maybe SanDisk does this as well, is just look to see if the names are all, for instance, you have the name of a file, that should be a valid ASCII character, should look like the valid name of a file. And if it's some weird character like a carriage return, you know something corrupted that piece of data. Is that what it's looking at?
That's a good example of the type of things that it does. It looks at your files and your directories. It makes sure that they're stored properly, that there isn't two pieces of data pointing to the same storage location. I mean, imagine having a file folder and it's stuffed with more stuff than can fit, and things are likely to get destroyed. That's the type of thing that SanDisk will do. And it will repair what you're referring to is sort of a damaged header, for example, in a file that, if not corrected, then means you might not be able to access your important letter to grandma or business document.
Because you can't type it again. You can't type that name again.
No, grandma would be upset. She wants it delivered right away.
I see. But if you're in a Windows kind of environment where it shows you the names and you select it, you might actually be able to select that file again. You just because it's unprintable. Right.
Yeah, that's correct. And even in MS-DOS, you could select it. I don't want to panic users. This is a protection tool. Most of the time, of course, you're just fine and everything will work very well on your computer, but it's a way to provide additional safety.
It is interesting that over time we learn about those things that can go wrong with computers, and we can fix them. Like in something like a damaged header, you look them up and say, this is not a valid name. Type in what the name ought to be, or give it a substitute name so you can find it again. What else could go wrong?
Well, there are other things that can go wrong, such as I mentioned the example of two files pointing to the same location on your hard disk. That's a problem. Or another example of a problem is that you have information that isn't pointing anywhere at all. The analogy to that is the document that's in your office but not in your file cabinet, and you can't find it, and the computer can't find it either. So what SanDisk would do in that case is try to put the pieces back together and create a location for it so you could access that data.
Okay, now are you talking about if you look in this sort of table of contents up front and there's no name on a file, or if it says there's a whole section of the disk that we can't access with no name on it, that it goes and says, gee, we can't access it, so we'll give it a name so you can find it again? Is that what you're talking about, or something different?
It is an example that works. It's generally what is called lost clusters, which means there's information on your disk that is lost and not attached to any information that the computer could access. So that's another example of the type of thing that you can do with SanDisk. And it does lots of additional things, such as not only working on a normal system, it also works on a double space system, which is a system that uses Microsoft's new double space technology, which increases the capacity of your hard disk significantly, often by doubling it, hence the name. And it will also look at double space drives and diagnose and repair those as well.
What's a double space drive?
Well, what a double space drive is in actuality your drive size hasn't changed per se, but by using compression technology, by looking for matches in your data and replacing those matches with tokens that require less space, we can take the same document that took up a whole file folder before, to use the file cabinet analogy, and have it take up half of a file folder. So double space is a technology that, by shrinking your files per se, doubles your hard disk capacity. But to the user, it's all transparent. They never see it. It all works in the background, and it's just like using your computer every day as you do today.
Now let's talk about this compression a little bit. If I have a letter to Aunt Trudy, we got Grandma's letter off, now we're on Aunt Trudy, how can that be cut in half?
Well, actually, when you think about it, it's not so difficult at all. Let's say you're writing a letter to Aunt Trudy and you write in the document many times Aunt Trudy or Trudy. Well, what double space will do is say, I recognize the pattern Trudy, and rather than take up the same amount of space for the word Trudy every time, it will replace Trudy with a character that takes up less space than the word Trudy. And then when you go to access a document, let's say you want to tell Trudy about, the additional things that happened when you went to the ball game, then we replace the token with Trudy. And the token takes up less space than the full word Trudy does. And as a consequence, we could take up less space on your computer.
So in a word processing type of file, you're looking word for repeats?
It's actually not done on a word basis. And, of course, under the covers, it's done based on how the information is stored. But it'd be easier to think of it as looking at a character or two. It's probably the best everyday analogy I could give.
So it's looking at strings of characters.
That's correct.
Well, at some point, you're working on your document. It's all expanded because you have to be able to see it.
Correct.
And then you store it, and it's at the storage point that it's got to kind of look at the whole thing and compress it. Doesn't that take a long time?
You would think it would, but in actuality, most users will never even notice the difference. And in fact, in many cases, you run faster with a compressed system than a non-compressed system. Double space increases the speed of your system because data stored in memory, there's actually twice as much data stored because everything's double spaced, so to speak. So there can be cases where there's a performance hit. I barely know a customer except when they have an older, slower machine where they may notice the difference. And in fact, recent indications from leading magazines such as PC Magazine indicate that often it's faster.
You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Brad Chase. He's the general manager for Microsoft's DOS, the operating system, which is the industry standard for PCs. Okay, we've talked about scan disk, and we've talked about compression, but there's something new about how version 6.2 is being released.
Yeah, that's correct. We have a lot of benefits in the product that can extend to the everyday user of PCs, whether you're in a small business or in a large company. Yet, there's a small group of customers out there who feel comfortable with PCs and who understand it well. So one of our objectives with MS-DOS 6.2 was to reach out to the customer who is afraid of PCs or is not knowledgeable to MS-DOS, doesn't want to be knowledgeable about MS-DOS, but wants the benefits such as doubling your disk and memory, et cetera, that the product provides. So what we've done is partner with Dan Gookin, who's the author of a book called DOS for Dummies. And what we've done is take the software in the book, put them together in a package that provides anyone the opportunity to learn about MS-DOS, to install it easily without having to worry about becoming an expert, because MS-DOS 6.2 and DOS for Dummies, it's all very simple and written in very easy language with humor and things like that attached to it.
For the veterans, they'll go and they'll either get directly from Microsoft or go to their local computer dealer and they'll get their new version 6.2 on a disk with a few notes that say here's what's changed. And for people who are just starting out new, rather than having to buy that and the manuals and then go and try to buy another disk, they can just go and buy the book and the disk will be in there.
That's correct. They could go to their regular software store or to a bookstore or many other places that will carry the DOS for Dummies MS-DOS 6.2 combination. And if they have a system now that doesn't have MS-DOS 6.2 on it, they could buy this package. And without being experts and without having to worry about the sort of the intimidation factor of software manuals that many people feel or the jargon that they don't understand, they can get this package and feel very comfortable getting the benefits of MS-DOS.
You're not a technical person. How did you get to be the general manager of MS-DOS? I mean, this is like one of the most technical jobs in the world.
I started on MS-DOS as a person who helped launch MS-DOS 5. And as a non-technical person, in some sense, I have a benefit because I have a good understanding of what the vast majority of users need and require in MS-DOS. And in a sense, it's not to say that our technical people don't, but I also am able to combine the experience I've had being at Microsoft since July of 87. So I was given the opportunity to provide leadership for MS-DOS with version 6, and I think that my background as sort of a practical user myself turns out to benefit the product because the features we added are very practical things that everybody can use. Like we've talked about, you know, data protection, doubling your hard disk, creating more space for your applications, or MemMaker, which is a way to provide easy memory optimization without having to be an expert.
How many releases have you had in total?
Well, boy, that would be hard to count, actually. We start with MS-DOS 1 well over 10 years ago now, probably about 12 years ago, would be my guess, 1981, I think. And then we've had various releases since then, such as we had a 1 and a 2, and we've had 0.1 releases, 3.1, 3.2, 3.3. So I would not be surprised if we've had well over 10 releases of MS-DOS, even though in terms of numbers, the new version is 6.2.
How do you jump from a 6.1 to a 6.2 as opposed to version 6 to version 7 or version 3 to version 4?
We try to have the set of features and the version number correspond in their enormity, so to speak. So when we went from 5 to 6, we added brand new data compression technology, a brand new memory management, for example. When we went with 6.2, we added new data safety technology and additional enhancements for double space, but it wasn't the same number of features that we added as 5 versus 6. It's sort of a gut feel as to what you think is appropriate in order to give your customers a feel for what you've added.
So in some sense, it may even be a marketing decision to say this is not a refinement, this is a major jump, and we want you to know that implicitly by the numbering.
That's correct.
How do you test a new release?
MS-DOS has gone through more testing than probably any product in the personal computer software industry because it's an operating system. And the most important thing about the operating system, in addition to everything we've discussed, is that it has to run the applications and the computers and the hard disks and the CD-ROM drives and all the things on your system. So compatibility, or having everything work right, is what's most important. With MS-DOS, we do that through extensive internal testing, as well as very extensive beta testing, in which we send pre-release copies of the software to users who volunteer throughout the world, and they use the software, and they report back to us either through electronic mail or sometimes through the regular mail system, the problems that they find. We investigate those problems. We reproduce them in our labs back at Microsoft. We fix the problems. We send out new versions, and the process iterates over time until we get all the problems that we feel we have to fix out of the product, and customers can feel real satisfied that it's a real solid product.
My guest today is Brad Chase, General Manager for DOS, the disk operating system produced by Microsoft. I'm Moira Gunn, and you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Another question I have about the version numbering is that every time you have a small refinement, which might lead you from a 5.1 to a 5.2, that's just a small update or a small number of new functions that you would get. When you go from 5.2 or whatever the number was up to 6.0, you'd get a lot more functions. Does it cost the same no matter every release change, or is that different too?
No, actually, it doesn't cost the same. We try to keep that into account as we do our pricing. A lot of customers like the refinement versions better because they feel you've had additional time with the software and more customers have used it, and they like those versions. But nonetheless, even though in total the number of features is less, we charge less. And for example, with MS-DOS 6.2, if you're an MS-DOS 6 user, either you got it on a new machine or you upgraded via the product available in stores, you can get MS-DOS 6.2 a couple different ways. One way is via what we call the step-up. And the step-up is a very small package. List price is $9.95, and software stores and other stores around the country will carry it, and you just go in and buy it, and it's only one disk, and it's very easy. You pop it in and follow the instructions, and you'll move quickly from 6 to 6.2. In addition, if you have access to electronic bulletin boards, such as CompuServe, we will actually put the step up on the bulletin board and allow you to download it at no charge at all as a customer service.
Who decides those cryptic error messages come out? Do you keep this person in a closet? I want to know.
it's actually a deep trade secret that I can't tell. No, I'm not serious. The cryptic error messages is something that we don't like, actually. And it's sort of become a part of computer history to get an abort, retry, fail message, which actually frustrates me significantly. And we have worked hard to try to improve the error messages, particularly on the newer features. And I, in fact, set a whole set of rules for my team, such that the rules have to be short, they have to be simple, they have to tell the user what to do. So a lot of the cryptic error messages are historical. They've been around for 10 years when the people running the software and the people using the software were generally experts. And now, with a much wider usage of computers, we have worked much harder to improve the error messages. And in fact, that's an improvement to 6.2. The double space error messages have been refined to be even easier and simpler to understand.
Well, MS-DOS has certainly had a fine run. Are there any competitors?
Yeah, well, in some sense, the thing that is evolving beyond MS-DOS is Windows. Right now, Windows, which is the most popular operating system in a sense, builds on MS-DOS and is being provided to most customers on almost all new machines. And in fact, Windows applications, which are applications that take advantage of the features of the Windows operating system, are much more popular than MS-DOS-based applications. Now, Windows runs MS-DOS applications, so that's another benefit. It allows people to evolve and get all the benefits that Windows provides, which is a much more graphical operating system that's much easier to use, usually much more powerful and much easier applications, and still run the MS-DOS apps they have if they're not ready to upgrade those applications to Windows. So in some sense, Windows is the greatest competition, in a sense, for MS-DOS, but that's actually a good thing because I think Windows makes computing much easier for customers. And in fact, even in MS-DOS 6.2, we have designed that product, since Windows and MS-DOS work together, we've designed that product as a product for Windows users. And we have Windows Undelete, Windows Backup, Windows Antivirus in MS-DOS 6.2.
Now, we've got a couple of concepts here. First of all, Windows isn't another application loaded on top of MS-DOS. It's an operating system unto itself.
Well, it is an operating system unto itself, but it builds on MS-DOS, so it sort of uses the MS-DOS file system and builds on it. So in a sense, it does load on top of MS-DOS, but it's also an operating system because it has its own what we call in the industry APIs. I can't think of a simple way to explain it, but what it has in it is the information necessary for applications to write programs. So it has its own memory management. It has its own information for products like Excel or Word for Windows so that they can write their applications and take advantage of Windows. So in some sense, it's an operating system, but it also uses the MS-DOS operating system, particularly for storage of files.
How many DOS commands are there?
Probably the more relevant question is, how many MS-DOS commands do people use every day?
It's a different question for sure.
Yeah. To be fair, there's a set of probably 15 commands that people use a lot, like delete and move and format and copy. And there's a whole set of other commands that probably users should never use that, in fact, even myself, there's many I don't know how to use that have a long history and tradition, because MS-DOS actually was the operating system that came after something called CPM. And way back at the first version of MS-DOS, there were people concerned about having compatibility with CPM. So there's commands in MS-DOS that are not very useful, and in fact, many we've taken out.
Who decides what the commands are going to be?
In the end, I do. Which leads me to...
Now we know who to call.
Yeah. Well, actually, I do encourage letters, and we get a lot of them. And it's really great to hear from customers. And you hear great stories, fun stories, and customers who have strong feelings about what you should add or take away. One of the things that makes MS-DOS very interesting is that many commands that we would like to take away or improve, or some of those cryptic error messages, for example, we can't change because over the 10, well, actually now 12 years that MS-DOS has been around, people have gotten used to them, and in some cases, programs have taken advantage of them. And one of the lessons of software is what's easy is what you know. So you have to be careful to make the new things very simple without changing the old things that, while cryptic to a new user, are actually very comfortable and easy to an experienced user.
How many people work on MS-DOS at Microsoft today?
Wow. The number of people who work on MS-DOS today varies because at certain parts of the cycle we hire more testers, for example. But I'd say there's the core team of people is around 50 or 60 people.
And how many of those are programmers?
I'd have to count. I'd say about 20-30%.
What programming languages is DOS written in?
Well, it's written in assembly language, and we also use things like C. to write some of the tools and utilities. There's a number of languages that are involved because of the history and the different components and their origins.
How many lines of code does it represent?
That's actually a good question. I don't know the answer to that question.
He doesn't know. The general manager doesn't know. I like this.
Yeah, well, I'm being honest.
How thick is the listing?
Oh, my gosh. Well, we have a special server at Microsoft just for storage of the source code and every build of the product so that we can track it. And, you know, MS-DOS itself, even now with all the tools and the various things added to it, can take, you know, probably as much as 5 or 6 megabytes of space on your system. And, of course, that's a trend in the entire industry. Programs are getting bigger and bigger, which is why the double space feature is so popular, because people need the space on their systems. Windows has grown so much in popularity, and Windows applications are big. Notebook PCs are very popular, and their hard drives are small. All that combined makes double space a very attractive feature for customers, because it's a lot easier and less expensive than buying a new hard disk, which try putting that into your system yourself.
That's right. One thing that we are used to now is that the hard disks are getting physically smaller, but space-wise, capacity-wise, larger. And it's good to understand that part of that capacity is in the software. I think another way I used to see disks really get corrupted, have a problem, that we thought maybe was hardware, turned out to be software. You'd have an application running, could be just about anything you were running, and somebody would come up and turn off your computer. And you don't know what those applications are using. They could be creating temporary files out on the disk. They could be doing any number of things. You turn it off, especially when your child turns it off.
I have two of my own.
There you have it. That's the kind of thing that can put a big blob out in the middle of your hard disk. There's nothing wrong with it physically, but you have to be able to get out there and recover it somehow. And these kind of options can really help you get the most out of your system.
Yeah, that's correct. People over the time have learned that it's very important to practice what I call good computer fitness, because of children and power outages and just mistakes because of either, you know, human error in the software or you know, electronic errors in the hardware, whatever. And it's important to use the new tools in MS-DOS 6.2, like backup, like antivirus to check for viruses, like ScanDisk that we talked about, and use those tools to help provide additional protection. And, for example, just backing up your system regularly is a good practice. You take your car for a tune-up, back up your system. It's sort of a similar thing. And then that day when your 5-year-old goes and turns off the computer, at least you have all the work that you worked on because you backed it up very recently.
You've just made a really good point about you've got Windows applications and MS-DOS applications and all this type of thing. I've got a perfectly safe, sound, fit computer system here. Is it dangerous to go to 6.2? What about my other MS-DOS applications? Are they going to work? How much trouble can I get in, and are you going to help me?
Well, first of all, always be assured we're going to help you. We have support lines you could call. But the good thing is that most people never have to call them. That's the real good thing, because we've designed the MS-DOS 6.2 upgrade so that it goes in underneath your system, upgrade your system from whatever version of MS-DOS you have to 6.2 without affecting any of your MS-DOS or Windows applications, and does it all seamlessly and under the covers. It's really nice. And in fact, we even have what we call the uninstall feature, which is your insurance, so to speak, because if any weird thing does go wrong, you could just pop that in and get yourself back to where you were before. So it's very easy to upgrade to 6.2 and get the benefits of, you know, doubling your hard disk to make more space for your applications, being able to optimize memory with MemMaker, the data protection tools we talked about like ScanDisk, backup, antivirus, etc. So you don't have to worry about your applications. You don't have to worry about your data. You'll get all the benefits of MS-DOS 6.2 without having to change the way you work or become a computer expert.
Brad, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
My guest today has been Brad Chase. He is Microsoft's General Manager for DOS, the industry standard operating system for PCs. For TechNation, I'm Moira Gunn.
Yeah. This broadcast was brought to you in part by the Tech Museum of Innovation in San Jose, California. The Tech is dedicated to the spirit of innovation in Silicon Valley and throughout the world. Associate producer for Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is Monte Carlos. Recording engineers are Howard Gelman, Ed Herman, and Seal Muller. The music direction is by Sean Breen, with original music composition by San Francisco songwriters. Title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. If you'd like a cassette tape or to receive a complete program catalog, call 1-800-959-3430. That's 1-800-959-3430. Send your written comments to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, Post Office Box 590-607, San Francisco, California, 94159. This program was produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is a production of MogoTech Media.